Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema. You can get your free month trial of Mubi at mubi.com/filmstage.
I took my troubles down to Madame Rue. You know that gypsy with the gold cap too. She's got a pad down a pretty broken pine. Selling little bottles of love potion number.
Back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. You know, I've never really thought about it before. I wonder if we have any unofficial podcasts, like people just out there podcasting about us. Anyway.
Podcasting about our podcast?
Yeah. No joke, a friend of mine and I once had the thought of we should do a /filmcast cast. Where we just review episodes of the Slash Film Cast like the day after they come out. We decided not to do that because that sounded crazy.
You're going to get a cease and desist.
That would have been hilarious, honestly. But anyway, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, as always, we have Michael Snydell.
Hello.
And Bill Graham.
Woo!
Yeah! All right, today we are talking about two different movies. The first will be a mini-review of The Love Witch, which I'm sure everyone out there in listenerland has heard about. And then we will be talking about The Edge of 17. I have that right, correct? There is a definite article in front of both of these?
Yes, The Love Witch and The Edge.
Okay,
yes.
Thank God, because we all know that's the biggest problem I have during any given episode. Is whether or not there's a definite article in the movie name.
It needs to be accurate.
It does. It's what was the there was one that I continuously screwed up like while recording and it nearly drove me to madness. And
I know what you're talking about, but I don't know what you're talking about, if that makes sense.
It was definitely
sense.
Like the hell or high water, right?
The hell or the high water. Yeah, it was that one. I want to say it might have been Queen of Earth. Or some nonsense like that. Maybe it was to the stars? Maps to the stars? I think that's what it was.
The,
right
the
now
fault
I'm
in our stars.
Oh yeah, the it was definitely the fault in our stars. I had to fucking read that book for a book club at this office I worked at where I was trying to fit in and I made a girl cry. Anyway, let's
wow, Brian.
I had a very low opinion of the fault in our stars. And I didn't realize that...
And apparently of this girl.
No, I didn't realize that someone had lobbied for this book because they'd read it before and loved it. So I, like, went on a tear, and then I said, I can't believe we got hoodwinked into reading this trash.
What did you think was going to happen? It was a book club.
I don't know. I didn't realize that she had read it before and was like, oh my God, guys, we need to read this. And then everyone was like, oh, there's this new guy and he's always reading during lunch. We should ask him to be part of our book club. I don't know why you'd look at a man who's reading Skag Boys, the prequel novel by Irvin Welsh to Trainspotting, and say, you should read The Fault in Our Stars. What are we talking about? How did we get so off topic? I don't know. Let's tell the people where it can be found. Before we get into things, you can follow us on Twitter at Filmstage Show. We have begun tweeting out what we are going to watch any given weekend so that you can hop on it and be prepared. You can also follow us on Facebook. Look for The Film Stage Show, and you can email us podcast@thefilmstage.com. And yeah, that's about it. Let me remind everyone that we are brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema. Mubi has curators who choose wonderful films for you to watch. Every film gets 30 days in rotation before it disappears and is replaced by a new film. That's a new film every single day that you have 30 days to watch. You can download them to your devices. You can show them to your friends. You can bring them out into the, I don't know, if you're a coal miner, for instance, bad cell reception in a coal mine, but you can go down there and on your union mandated 15-minute break, you can watch a movie film that you have already downloaded on your phone. Coal mines are still run like it's the 1920s, right?
Yeah,
I have to assume so. I've watched Justified. They spend some time in coal mines. Michael Snydell, we're going to be talking about The Love Witch today.
And yeah, no, guys, I meant to Anna say that the previous Anna Biller film is on Mubi. I actually watched it last night.
Which film is that?
Viva.
And how was that? Do you want to talk about that when we actually start talking about The Love Witch? Because I'm interested.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I can just talk to it about it a little bit in conversation because I wanted to get a greater sense of who Biller is and whether this was an anomaly.
All right. Well, if you, too, would like to watch Viva, the previous film by Love Witch director Anna Biller, it is on Mubi. So get on it. You can go to mubi.com/filmstage and you will get a free 30-day trial of Mubi. So that means that if a movie that you see the day that you sign up is added and you're like, oh, I want to watch that, by the time that your free trial runs up, you will still be able to watch that movie. It's pretty great.
Nice.
Yes. All right. So let's, I guess let's do this thing. There's not really a theme to this week. I guess, you know, female oriented films or female starring movies that were also directed and written by females, which is great. We start off with The Love Witch, again, written and directed by Anna Biller. And here is the trailer.
After Jerry died, the cops wouldn't stop harassing me. They couldn't prove anything. They actually thought that I killed him. Anyways, San Francisco got to be a really bad trip after you left. And that's when I remembered you had that extra apartment.
Hey.
Hi, I'm Trish.
Hi, Trish.
Well, what do men want?
Just a pretty woman to love and to take care of them.
Love me.
So that's the trailer for Love Witch. Let's talk about it. Never have I been more happy that I always make myself go last during these. Michael Snydell, what did you think of The Love Witch?
Well, guys, I mean, I had read like briefly about this. I mean, I wasn't prepared in any way, but I'd read briefly about this. And, you know, I guess the best way to even start to talk about this is you just kind of have to accept a lot of different contradictions. So the movie is very much an homage to a very like classical type of cinema, down to not just the look, which like it has a very vivid, vibrant color palette that, you know, like evokes, you know, everything from like, you know, 60s Vincente Minnelli musicals to like Mario Bava to like all of these very diverse Hollywood traditions. But then it's also very, very rooted in contemporary like feminist conversation. So it's also strange in the sense that it's about basically a sociopathic woman, but it's also about, you know, female empowerment and about like the purity of female desire and like how creepy males can be. And it's really, I watched this with my girlfriend and we had a really fascinating experience with it. I mean, we were kind of entranced with it for the whole thing, just because it is so completely committed to its aesthetic. And its aesthetic is not just, so I kept mentioning visual aesthetics, but it's also the dialogue and editing. Mm-hmm. She, as you mentioned, she directed and wrote, but she also crucially edited and designed the film. Mm-hmm. And the editing is almost the main thing you can bring up to just talk about how the film actually works within flow, because it is very specifically designed in a way to feel awkward in literally every scene. Like things are held too long. Zooms happen at random moments. You have dialogue that's presented in like this, like declamatory, like presentational style, like to the camera. And it's just filled with puns and dad jokes at every point. And there's weird sight gags, like giant cups. And it's a really interesting experience. It's also way too long. But as far as one of the most unique experiences I've had this year, I mean, I have to give it some credit just for all the things it's trying to do. But it still is – the thing about it is that it – as much as it is committed to what it is doing and it's – you know, it constantly has its tongue firmly in cheek, it's also supposed to be very sincere. And it just didn't completely work for me at times, especially because it goes from these – lines of dialogue that seem very much like in the realm of fantasy and in the realm of like melodrama, but then like it pivots to like active lecturing, and the lecturing is interesting, but it still constantly breaks up the film. So I mean yeah, honestly, I'm gonna recommend this to anyone who is even like kind of okay with adventurous cinema, but it's not I can't get behind like some of the rapturous praise. And I'm sorry, I'm going for a long time, but I just want to quickly say, so watching Viva is again about sexual liberation. It's about a group of characters who are literally straight from Playboy. So it's about a bored housewife and how she lets loose, and how even when she tries to let loose, she still runs into contact with that all the world is still kind of a gross place. So yeah, it's very much in line with this, and actually is even more edited even more awkwardly. Like there's like whole scenes in that film where like it's just about someone saying a line of dialogue and then laughing hysterically. So it's like a Tim and Eric sketch. Oh, like it's but it's so damn sincere. Like it's, and that's the thing that's so weird about this. So yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if I quite think it actually works as a film, but it's certainly interesting to talk about, and I enjoyed watching it.
All right, Bill Graham.
this film, if you go in not quite realizing what it is, you will be mystified from the outset. Thankfully, it kind of is so upfront about what it kind of is that within the first 5 minutes you kind of settle down and you're like, oh, okay, I guess this is the movie that we're going to be watching. So it's definitely upfront about the fact that this is definitely kind of a throwback to an era. In fact, Biller, whatever her name is, she collaborated with her cinematographer, who I guess is an expert in kind of period film, which is kind of hilarious because I didn't think you really needed to. I guess what they're using is just super harsh lighting like 90% of the time. So that's how far out of the way she went to make sure it looks a certain way. And the film, like Michael was saying, is far too long. It hits my two hour mark.
Yep.
Yeah, right on the dot. But yeah, this is one of those exceptions where I'm like, nah, you could shave 30 minutes of this film. I think the character interactions are so interesting. I mean, we can get into the camp and everything like that, but I think what's really interesting is how the characters react to the world that is actually up on screen. And I think Samantha Robinson as Elaine, this kind of new witch that is very, very comfortable as being a witch. Like she's a new witch from what we learn kind of narratively. But she seems like she's like 100% in, like 110% in. Like, she's just like, nah, this is what I was meant to be doing.
She's like a person like, okay, who like just started doing CrossFit, but like won't stop talking about CrossFit. Like one of those people.
Yes. Yeah. She just, yeah, she, and she got the new shoes, she got the new clothes, and she's like, I'm in, guys, I'm in. And then like 2 months later,
tractor wheel.
Yeah. 2 months later, they, you know, are, you're like, what happened? And they're like, nah, it didn't work out.
Now I'm
like,
a Zumba person.
Yeah, now I'm a Zumba purpose. But yeah, so she is like all in to the point where she moves into, it's probably one of my favorite set pieces is her apartment. She moves into this apartment that is just filled with all of these occult things. And I guess paintings of from her that were shipped earlier. I'm not sure, because her paintings look an awfully like the paintings that are actually in the apartment that she comes into.
I love that they don't explain that at
yeah.
all.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, this film is Coco Bananas. And in some ways it's the best kind of Coco Bananas, and in some ways it's the most just kind of almost insulting to it, really my biggest issue surrounds Elaine, and it surrounds how her character is kind of portrayed and pulled off. She's portrayed as this woman that kind of has everything together. Well, and not even that so much as she kind of has a plan, right? And as soon as things go off the rails, she starts to cry and become emotional, and she starts to do the same things that she's lamenting in the men that surround her. And it's kind of hilarious to see how much power she gets from this, and also how little control she's able to actually have over the situation. And so I think that's probably the most interesting thing about this film. At one point she is supposed to be kind of strong, and she ends up being just kind of easily overtaken, and you're just like, what is this film? And you know, going back to how the film kind of ends, you're just like, yeah. So this film is, I don't understand the praise for it. I get that this is definitely a throwback, that this is definitely a interesting look, but I'm not sure that there's any kind of consistency in the character portrayals. Now the subject matter and things like that, I think are actually pretty interesting. Especially how, you know, the witches are kind of billed as these people that are taking back feminism and, you know, sexuality and kind of just all about like using that to empower themselves. And I'm not sure how much even like some feminists would even agree with that. It's interesting. So,
well,
Bill, can I respond to that real quick?
Sure.
You know, I think I don't want to say that's the point, because there is still some inconsistencies I find there, but I think that it's very intentional, for instance, that when we see, you know, the other witches and how they're treated there, that it's supposed to be like, hey, these people are, or not these people, but, you know, these women are taking up witchcraft, and it was supposed to be this point of power. And, you know, they can seem to do everything for this first, you know, hour of the movie, for instance. But then it turns out that, no, it turns out they don't have any actual power at all. I feel like that's the message that's trying to put forth. And I do definitely see what you're saying in how there's some inconsistency there. But I think that, like, especially inconsistency in how, like, if you read especially where the film goes, like, it becomes a much, much darker and pessimistic tone than the rest of the movie. Mm-hmm. And I think that feels – but I think that's very much the point, that, like, we're supposed to see a character who's in power, and it turns out she's also totally powerless, or even in that moment of power, she's still being – you know, objectified by creepy bearded men.
Yeah, she, so I guess my thoughts, it's a beautiful movie. One of the more visually lush films that, that you'll see this year, if you decide to see it. I have no idea if I would recommend this movie to someone, because, like, outside of people who really, really dig, like, the craft that must have gone into this on, like, a cinematic academic level, I don't know who the hell this movie would be for. It's not, like, weird enough to be a curiosity. It's not on point enough to be a parody. It's got a weird kind of earnestness to it that, like, if you told me that this was, like, a failed film from the 70s or 60s that became a cult classic, I'd believe you, which is to the film's credit, because it's not like they took a bunch of modern looking people and, like, put them into this. Like, these people look like they have probably been dead for 20 years now. like if you were like, oh yeah, he was a big actor, he died in 1980, I'm like, oh okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. To me,
Coke overdose.
Yeah. Yeah, coke overdose, like, disco accident, whatever happened. Yeah, it was a real bad disco accident. Yeah. Like, for instance, like, she keeps idolizing this guy Jerry, and Jerry's just the ugliest looking motherfucker. And but it's like, I believe that there was a time, like 4 months during 1962, that was an attractive man. And
that Donny Osmond looking motherfucker. Yeah.
So, like, things like that are cool, but, like, they don't sustain a 2-hour movie. And sometime around the point when, like, she's like riding a horse and,
yeah,
like, ends up at a Ren Faire, I was like, what the shit is going on? Like, what is happening here? And it's hard to say. I think that's a feature and not a bug, but it's not a feature that I want. That, and again, like, these scenes of, like, just people espousing ideas, like, looking directly at the camera, like, yeah, I get it, but I'm not into that. I don't want that from a movie.
So it's interesting. I want to bring this up while you're kind of in the middle of this, because it reminds me so much of what kind of Ty West was doing with House of the Devil.
Yeah, it definitely had that vibe to it.
And I just wish that this film had him in the director's seat, or at least the climactic end had him in the director's seat, because I think it would be so much fun to see this just completely go off the rails. And
I don't think that's what it was trying for.
No, I understand that's I understand that's not what it's going for at all, but that would bring me so much more pleasure than what actually happens on screen, which is
I'd rather have watched The Grey than this, but that doesn't mean that I wish that Joe Carnahan had directed this. What I'll say is, it would be interesting to see Ty West go for something like this, but, like, from this movie, I feel like this movie does everything it wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't feel like they lost control. I don't feel like they had to compromise. I feel like if you were to sit all these people down and say how you feel about this, they'll be like, greatest, like, 4 months of my life. This was fantastic. It's exactly what we want. And that's great.
Yeah.
There's bound to be someone out there who wants that too. I was hoping for more of a Black Dynamite vibe. If I had been a smarter man.
But that is, like, a parody. Like, that is something that condescends to Blaxploitation, where this, like, but it feels also so loving.
Well, I was going to say, I think that Black Dynamite is super loving, but it's loving in the way that, like, you can only make fun of the people you love a certain way. And if you were to make fun of someone that you didn't like in that same way, they'd probably murder you in your sleep. Because you have so much affection, you can kind of probe deeper depths. And I'm fine with this not being Black Dynamite, because, again, it's not trying to be. And it's just, I just don't know that I want what this is selling. Like, I go to an oyster bar, and I don't like oysters. I'm not going to order those oysters. But I'm not going to, like, give it a 1-star review on Yelp, because I don't want any fucking oysters. Like, that's my fault for going to an oyster bar.
Sure.
So that's kind of where I'm at. But
I'm just pushing back on the pastiche and homage conversation because I think like this is trying to bring a very specific experience too. Like it doesn't, I don't feel like it's rehashing old narratives. And that's what I would say about something like Black Dynamite. Like Black Dynamite is funny as hell and I really like Black Dynamite, but it's not actually trying to bring anything new to those characters. It's trying to play on narratives that already exist. And I feel like this is very specifically trying to transpose Biller's very specific worldview and contemporary viewpoints.
Right.
But here's... not necessarily onto that old aesthetic, but a imitation of that aesthetic.
Here's my other problem. I get super uncomfortable during conversations about identity politics. Because I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say to like not be a bad person. One of the weirdest things to ever happen to me was I saw like three women at a party like shouting at each other and calling each other like traitors, and I was like, oh man, did like a girl who just wants to be like chained to an oven talk to a woman who wants to burn her bra? Because I only think in stereotypes from the 1960s. And
you should go watch a movie by then.
And so I asked someone, I'm like, what is this? Like, is this like a feminist versus like an anti-feminist? And like, no, those are three different types of feminists. And I was like, I believe that those people would murder each other. How can they all be feminists? And the person then explained it to me, and I don't remember what it was, but they had very different ideas about what feminism was. Like, one of them was like, I can be a feminist and be pro-life. And the other one was like, no, you're enslaving us to the patriarchy. And then the other one was like, you can't tell her what to think because that's not feminist. You're not letting her be an authentic woman. And then the first one was like, it doesn't matter. She's not being an authentic woman if she thinks this way. And so it was like, I don't know. So
liberal,
I can't...
radical, and essentialism.
What was that?
Liberal, radical, and essentialism.
Then I
essentialism.
Fucking guess. Sure. I'm glad that you have those words to deploy. I don't know. And so, like, watching this movie, I wasn't sure what was meant to be parody and what was earnest. I did know that it was weird that this witchcraft thing that seemed to be about female liberation was being taught by one of the grossest men I have ever seen. So that seemed funny, but like I don't have a deep enough knowledge to know what is being espoused earnestly and what is being honestly critiqued. So during every point where there was like a deeper conversation going on, I was like, I'm just gonna I don't know what I'm gonna do right now. I'm super uncomfortable and I'm glad I'm watching this alone.
Yeah, see, I love that stuff because that is making me question, like, okay, any beliefs I have, I'm still like, wait, why am I thinking this is in the realm of parody? Why am I thinking this is, like, at what point am I bringing my own biases in? At what point am I bringing social biases? Like, I like when all of those, that this film doesn't ever prioritize one view. And even the one view that it does prioritize, it fucks her over.
Well, I mean, the other thing is like, I don't know about like at the same party or a different party. Obviously, I have a lot of parties with people who claim to be feminist. Someone has said to a guy, "Are you a feminist?" And he said, "No, I'm an ally." And then again, two different arguments sprung up. One, sure, whether it's wrong for a man to say that he's not a feminist, or two, if it is wrong for a man to say he is a feminist because then he's co-opting feminism from women. So that's kind of where I'm at. Like, I don't know. So from an intellectual standpoint, the movie was difficult for me to come to terms with. I would love to get a bunch of feminists together and then listen to them converse about it afterwards. For me, it was an interesting aesthetic exercise, but I don't know if I could ever really say like you should watch The Love Witch, because God only knows how people react to this. And I think that's part of its charm. I think if you're interested, you should see it. Yeah, I don't know. That's about it. I don't know.
Well, Bill, what do you make of the identity politics? I'm pretty curious.
I'm with Brian. I'm hesitant to wade into it because it's not something that I'm well versed in enough to make kind of a judgment. But I think this film's themes and the way it goes about talking about them is obviously very conversational and at times kind of lecture-y, but it's, I don't know, again, to me, my biggest concern with this film is just it's not necessarily the narrative that I'm concerned with. The narrative is what it is, like Brian was saying. I just worry about the consistency of characters and how they're drawn, and I just don't feel like Elaine is drawn as consistent as I would hope her to be. At least because we see her from the inside and we also see her from the outside. And for the most mm-hmm. part, except for early in the film, she seems so confident. She seems so put together. And we're seeing her before she sees people and we're seeing her after she's, you know, put on her front and put on her makeup and everything like that. And I wish it would have dealt more with her kind of second guessing and kind of having these issues when she's alone, when she's, you know, not performing in front of someone, so we can kind of understand where her character is coming from. Because
they coexist.
Yeah, we see her. One of my favorite recurring motifs is her working at her lab, mm-hmm. I guess, apothecary. And wearing a lab coat, and then like someone knocks at the door and she pulls off her lab coat and she's wearing some fucking crazy outfit underneath of it, just like ready to go.
Yeah.
I don't know. Stuff like that was funny to me. Moments where like there's a scene that legitimately feels like it goes on for 5 minutes where two people are just smiling at each other and it's cutting between their faces as like voiceover from like conversations they've had in the past plays. And I'm like, this is super awkward. I dig it, but Jesus.
Yeah.
So I guess final thoughts on The Love Witch. Should people see this? Bill?
I would say it's a curiosity for sure. I don't have much else to add to that.
That's about where I'm at. Yeah, I think I'm never going to tell someone who's interested not to watch it, but I'm not going to like, I can't think of who I would openly say like, dude, you should watch The Love Witch.
Here's my thing. All right. Again, this goes back to Arrival. This goes back to a lot of my kind of theory on the benefits of film and art and things like that. And is this a conversation starter? Absolutely. So in the strictest sense of, will this be something interesting to talk with anybody, right? Not just someone that this film is specifically catered to, but anyone. I would be curious to see how you react to this film and what you have to take from it.
Maybe don't bring the most socially repressed person you know to sure. it for various reasons.
Oh, really? Because I was going to show this at Thanksgiving. Is that a bad idea? All right. Well, that's our review of The Love Witch, such as it is. Let's move on now into our primary review, which will be The Edge of 17. This is a film by Kelly Freeman Craig. And it stars Hailee Steinfeld, as well as, from Everybody Wants Some, Blake Jenner. Also Kira Sedgwick from The Closer, and Woody Harrelson from My Dreams. Here is the trailer.
Hey.
Busy.
I don't want to take up a ton of your time, but I'm going to kill myself. I just thought that an adult should know.
Wow. I wish I knew what to say. You know, actually, I was writing my own suicide note just now. As some of you know, I have 32 fleeting minutes of happiness during lunch, which has been eaten up again and again by the same especially badly dressed student. And I finally thought I would rather have the dark nothingness. Have a nice life without me, fuckers.
There are two types of people in the world. The people who radiate confidence and naturally excel at life.
Golden boy.
What's up?
And the people who hope all those people die in a big explosion. Look at that stupid shirt my brother's wearing.
It screams, I have a body complex worse than a girl's.
Okay, so that is the trailer for The Edge of 17. Just to get it out of the way, Bill Graham, did you have a problem with the title of this film?
What?
I only ask because she's not at the edge of 17. She is firmly 17 in this movie.
Well, is she not about to turn 18?
I don't believe that's established.
Okay. Well, that's what I read.
We are killing this.
So this is a movie about a girl who is 17 and dealing with her problems, her issues with confidence and boys and friends, should be friends singular, and life in general. So this movie got a lot of positive buzz coming out of the Toronto International Film Festival, correct, Michael Snydell, you said?
Yes.
Okay, so that's why we watched it. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about The Edge of 17. Bill Graham, since Michael Snydell started last time, why don't you kick us off with your general thoughts on The Edge of 17?
Sure. This film, first off, if you don't quite know who Hailee Steinfeld is, she broke onto the scene in, what was that, 2013? 2001.
True Grit?
2011, right?
2010.
It definitely wasn't 2001, yeah.
I said 2001, I meant, yeah, 2011, but
that's
yeah, 2010. Yes, so that was 6 years ago. She busted onto the scene with True Grit. She was 13 at the time, and she was a little spitfire back then, literally ripped straight from the original source film. She was... got a lot of buzz out of that film, and here she is. We're picking up with her 6 years later. If you haven't followed her film career to that point, you're excused. and she, again, she, for some reason, this character, the way it's drawn, the way it's written, makes you almost want to hate her. Her character's name. Yeah, her character's name is Nadine, and throughout it, every time I heard her name said out loud, every time she kind of went off on someone that she should try and find not a mentor, but like a someone to lean on, she's constantly pushing back, and she's had kind of a string of incidents where you can kind of understand what's going on, but it's definitely interesting because somehow, some way, despite the fact that this character is written in such a way that you just almost, yeah, you kind of learn to despise her, you still root for her. And I think a lot of that has to do with Steinfeld herself. I think it's the way that she kind of carries herself, and the way that this film kind of works around it. But it's also because the characters around her, particularly Woody Harrelson, who starts the film off. And I think this is probably one of his best performances in quite a while, at least comedically. And it reminds me so much of why I really enjoy his kind of comedic timing and his dry sense of humor and the way that he's able to pull off this kind of quiet confidence of just not giving a fuck and yet like having a lot of fun with the role.
Yeah, I was going to say, have you already forgotten Now You See Me Too?
Yeah, I guess so. Because I never saw that film. Triple Nine, let's not talk about that. And
he was actually one of my only highlights in that one.
Yeah, his tweet Facebook thing, whatever.
Instagram.
That was
face.
Great. Yes. That was great. And I think it's really kind of the characters around Steinfeld that help keep the film afloat as long as it does. I found a lot of the issues that it was dealing with, I really started to... This film digs a hole for her about an hour in that you just don't see a lot of climbing out of. And the way it climbs out of it, I think, is pretty genuine, and it's pretty interesting, and it feels real. It feels really true. And I appreciated it that it definitely built stacked the deck against her, and the way it kind of rewards you for that narratively really works for me. The film is pretty darn funny, I found. And yeah, I think everyone here is on their game pretty much. Even Kira Sedgwick is doing pretty good work, I think. She's kind of a character, but she's... That's one of the best things about this film, is everyone kind of comes off as a caricature, because we're kind of seeing it from Nadine's point of view at first, and the more we get to know them, the more we kind of reveal different shades of things that they have, and so she's kind of discovering that as we're going along as well, and I appreciated that. So yeah, I found it a really delightful kind of high school film. Yep.
All right, Michael Snydell.
Yeah. You know, there's a long tradition that I think you can easily compare Hailee Steinfeld, even, you know, in the past decade, you know, things like Easy A or, oh wow, Juno was not in this decade, but okay. Anyway,
Juno,
you know,
she?
Those,
oh,
no,
oh,
no,
I'm
saying, heroes like that. Yes. And, but the thing about, that I really, really like about this film is that her insecurities are not played as devices. They're played as facts of life. And this isn't work in the way of a lot of teen movies in making her a romantic hero or anything like that. Like, as you're saying, Bill, like, a lot of times she says things and you're like, man, you're an awful person, but man, I kind of also remember doing that. And you know, the self-loathing is really baked in here in a way that I think, as you're saying, again, makes it really genuine. And the sense of her just being very impulsive and all over the place, and that being represented constantly, you know, like whether that's in loneliness of, you know, there's a scene early on where she leaves a party and she's home alone and her mom is like, she's just in the dark, like sitting on not a chaise lounge, a chair.
I love how you went while for chaise lounge before you went for chair.
Sorry. and her mom is like upstairs, like getting ready to go out. And it's just, there is like, this is like a teen coming of age film that is not about like, boys are a part of it and, you know, friends are a part of it, but it's just as much about like understanding that as you get older, like you want to find your self-worth and you don't want to compromise yourself, but you also have to fucking grow up and realize that everyone around you is also going through their own complicated things. Like as Bill was mentioning again, like the parents especially are, they don't start thin, but their motivations seem a lot more in conflict with Nadine than it's eventually revealed. And those things don't happen. Like there is a somewhat familiar three-act structure, but when it comes to a lot of main things, it pushes back on obvious ideas about like romantic comedies or the teen coming of age film. And I think that that's what makes it feel really good, is that much of that drama does not feel false. There's a few false notes that maybe we can speak about if we go into spoilers. And honestly, I'd have no idea why this movie has so much goddamn music. But other than that, I think this is something really worth checking out. And I just saw people are sharing right now that it made very, very, very little money this weekend. So honestly, this will probably be in my top 10. So I'll probably talk about it again at the end of the year.
What the fuck are you talking about? Seriously?
And fuck off, Ryan. You're up.
Holy shit. Okay. Wow. Okay. Your top 10?
Yep.
Fucking wow, man. All right. Jesus. So, I don't get it.
Okay, cool.
I just, like, this movie's pretty much like a Disney Channel original film with, like,
what the fuck are you talking
about? Two more F-bombs that give it an R rating. I mean, damn.
What Disney character is this self-loathing? All right, sorry. Go ahead.
The thing is, I don't find her self-loathing to be particularly peaked. Like, none of this struck me as, like, anything dramatically interesting. Because, like, from the moment the movie begins, I'm like, oh, great, this is going to be a tale of a person who realizes that, like, everyone else has some shit going on. And every character who's introduced, I'm like, oh, I know where this is going. And then it does. And it's not particularly fresh or innovative. It's especially in terms of, like, direction. Aesthetically, this is a fucking, like, catalog picture. And I just don't get it. Like, there's not a lot to talk about here. Like, every single thing that becomes established plays out exactly how you expect it will. Nothing ever goes too bad, and it's just, I don't know, there's not a lot of interest here, I guess.
Well, this has been this week's Film Stage Show. Thanks
for
listening.
Yeah, pretty much, like, I don't understand, I don't get it, like, her... Nothing makes sense to me right now. Damn. I don't know. Like, I guess I'm genuinely curious what the hell about this movie makes it top 10 material. Because I walked out of the theater and it literally was like, that was like Hallmark. This is like TV what? Movie. This is nothing. This is fine. I wouldn't have a problem with my daughter growing up and watching this and liking it, but, like, there's not a lot of anything interesting going on.
Okay.
Yeah, I just don't get it. Maybe when we, do we need a spoiler section?
Sure. I mean, obviously, if you're going to drop that bomb and then,
your smugness is so much fun, Brian. It's always a good time.
I mean, we could keep talking about it in a non-spoiler section, but, like, if you feel like we really need to dig into the finer points of the narrative twists and turns, then I guess we can have a spoiler section. Does anyone have anything to say in the non-spoiler section before we move on?
No. I'm ready to talk about it.
Okay. I mean, again, I'm not saying it's a bad movie. I will say that this movie made me like Moonlight more. Because while I had similar issues in terms of, like, predictability of narrative on the edges of Moonlight, I will say that this movie really made me realize that, like, I was a little too hard on Moonlight. I think Moonlight had more specificity and obviously a much better aesthetic handle. So, like, I walked out saying to myself, like, these are two movies that are about an experience that I'll never have, but one of them was clearly given a lot more thought and time and care and attention, and I don't think that I gave it enough credit for that, even though I feel like I did, but I think I've been gaslit into believing that I was super hard on Moonlight in every way, instead of just the ways that I had said. So I just want to put that out there. But Mike and Bill, you both think people should go out and see this?
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Spoilers for Edge of 17. I don't know. You guys talk.
Okay, I'll start it off. Sure. Cool. One of the first things that I kind of want to mention, and that kind of goes against kind of the Disney film aesthetic, and I definitely want to pull away from that kind of classification as soon as we can, because I don't want to deal with it too much. But the way that this film deals with sex is so refreshing to see as a kind of teen comedy. It's not like everybody is trying to get laid just to get laid, just to get rid of their virginity card or whatever. In fact, I don't even know if virginity is even brought up in this film at any point. One of my favorite aspects of this film is that Krista, the best friend of why
Nadine?
Kind of sleeps with her brother, and who's kind of portrayed as this delightful jock that doesn't have any really issues and everything like that and blah 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 blah. But really what it does for me that was really refreshing was that it deals with sexuality and sex at this time in a way that's just like it happens, and the mother is off to go sleep with some guy that she met on on like a dating app, match.com, and you know, we get all of these sexual kind of issues that arise. In fact, at several moments the best friend Krista and her brother don't even sneak off upstairs. They're just upstairs, and you're like, okay, I guess that's just okay. And to me, you know, it's interesting because the way it plays that is just so down the middle, and it's just so just nice about the fact that these characters really don't care that other people are having sex. And it's not a big deal. And I really enjoyed that aspect of it in particular.
Bill, but the other thing is, like, they're also very horny. But sure. That's, like, a separate – like, that's just a thing. That's what's great. Like, there's that scene with Erwin where he, like – where she's like, you want to have sex? And, like, it doesn't happen. And you can just see him, like, become really deflated. But it's not, like, the end of the world. It's not, like, the only thing that exists.
Mm-hmm.
Or even with, you know, the romantic interest, you know, the model douchebag who every profile picture is, like, in black and white, him against a brick wall. Go ahead, Bill.
What I love about that interaction in particular is that it could have gone into a very dark place, I think. And certainly, you know, it could have had a very rapey vibe to it. But in some ways, it goes through with that kind of theme and idea that if you sent a message to someone and they responded with, wow, hey, let's get together, like, their perception of what's about to happen is going to be very different than this girl that is just doesn't have her shit together and finally gets a opening that she just doesn't know what to do with, right?
And I will say that one of the things that I appreciated most about this film is its critique of the placement of the cancel and the send button on certain applications. That shit is real. And it's like, that should be UI, you know, day one courses. Like, why don't you put those things on the opposite side of the screen?
Sure. Yeah. The delete button isn't quite close enough. It's definitely, I think it's hilarious because, again, the way it deals with that situation is, I like his character's interaction with it more than hers. Like, I understand where she's kind of coming from, but it's also just pure naivete of her part to see an invite to hang out that night and not read it as kind of what it was, and it's her naivete in that
situation. You mean like you up?
Yeah. And like for her to not set boundaries to begin with, you know, is kind of interesting, because it's her naivete in that situation, because everything is just kind of spiraling and she finally has this one thing that she's kind of latching onto, and she just goes for it, and before she knows it, she's in a situation that she doesn't necessarily want to be in. And his reaction, I think, is kind of crucial, because again, it doesn't come off very rapey, but it's definitely like he is kind of like, okay, I got this message from you. What did, like, and you met up with me, and now what do we think is going to actually happen here? And
in front of the garbage dump, no less.
his placement and his timing are just pure
trash.
If he
had just turned like, the car around,
I know.
They would have been facing like a river. Like, what is wrong with this guy?
He's clearly a dodo head, because he works at Petland, and you know.
Hey, let's not slander the fine people who work at Petland.
Sure.
Some of those people have a deep love for pets.
Yes. I something tells me he does not.
Probably not, no. I feel like he murders pets.
Yeah.
So he works at Petland.
But I love that when she kind of calls him out, what he says is, my friends were right. I shouldn't have like messaged you back. Like, I shouldn't have taken this seriously. And you're just like, I guess that's a good way to get her out of the car at that moment. But it's also like, what the fuck? Like, that's
like
such
he's just as awkward in a way.
Yeah. He's just like, he's just as frustrated as she is at this interaction. Yeah. And it's interesting that, you know, it plays with that, and it gives it kind of a, like, he didn't know what to do in that situation either. And so he went to his friends, and his friends were like, no, dude, that chick's crazy. You don't need to be messing with that. Even though there's, you know, in high school, and it's like that is classic, like, easy lay kind of, you know, cliche. But it's like, oh. But even he is just like, I don't know what to do in this situation. I guess we're just going to swing for the fences. And nope, that didn't work. Okay. I don't know what to do now.
There would totally be a John Hughes movie, too, where his character would be the hero. And this would be his defining moment of losing his virginity or something. But like, yeah, that's, again, what you're saying, Bill, is like, none of these people are viewed as not heroes, but like the fact that they're so, because they live in today, they know everything, but they know nothing. Like the fact that they're, you know, they know all about sex, and they know, you know, they have this understanding of social etiquette, but it doesn't apply to anything. Like, and that's what is so interesting to me about this, is that, you know, her character is someone who is, you know, has these constant quips that are honestly very, very shitty. Like, she says just a lot of shitty things to people, and it's not played as something cute like what it's been in so many other movies.
No, like, even in that scene, the guy is like, what, now you're insulting my car too?
Yeah. And yeah, her recovery there is just like, you know, it's actually pretty clever the way that it goes about it. And I think like you're saying, Michael, the honesty that is being kind of spit at times is both venomous, and yet it feels kind of true to both this character and this film. The things that the people say to one another in this film are feel very like, even Blake Jenner, her brother Darian, at one moment they are having like a shouting match with each other, and his
in
mom
her teacher's
comes
house.
No. I was talking about it. Yeah. And her mom comes in and is like, you know, I need to, I need to know what is going on right now. And Jenner's reaction is, it's her. It's her issue. You know, not like claiming any responsibility for the way that he could potentially try and calm her down or do anything like that. It's such a sibling thing that I've witnessed so many times being a single, you know, an only child. I've witnessed this with other siblings so often where they're just like, they take no responsibility for their half of the argument. It's always someone else's fault. And it's always the brother or the sister's fault or, you know, the sibling's fault. And it's just like, there's two parts to an argument and
sure.
And both sides kind of ultimately can end up being blamed. And yeah, he's just like, nah, it's not my issue. And what does she do? She immediately tells him, no, it is your issue because you're the only person that I can talk to. And you're the only one that kind of listens to me. So, you know, unfortunately, you're in this situation where you're going to have to be kind of the older brother and the grown up. And I can't quite tell if her brother is actually older than she is or if they're the same age.
I think it's the same age, actually.
Well, because he's talking about. She says she's a junior, and he talks about applying to college. Mm-hmm. So I think there might be a one-year difference, but I definitely was like, well, he's obviously 25, and she's 17, so... Yeah. Like, for this is a dumb complaint, but, like, I had trouble with Blake Jenner being a college freshman in Everybody Wants Some, because I was like, that man is obviously 23. And then for him to be aged down even further in this movie, like, especially because at some point he plays 14-year-old or 13-year-old himself. And I was who is this college-aged man standing in her bathroom? And they don't even give him a shitty haircut like they give her.
Yeah. Yeah, they play fast and loose with that kind and of like visual.
It's even more disturbing because her best friend who starts dating him definitely looks like she could be in high school.
Yeah.
Yeah, she does look pretty young.
Which is the same
Haley
problem
Lou
I had.
Richardson.
Yeah, Haley Lou Richardson who plays Krista. But it's the same problem that I had again in Everybody Wants Some, because the college freshman that he starts dating definitely looks like she could be a college freshman or younger. She honestly looked like 13. And I'm just like, this full-grown man is predatorily going after these super young women.
Well, it's funny because, you know, you mentioned that he's struggling to play these characters that are in either high school or college, when he kind of came to prominence originally for Glee, which is from my best knowledge is mainly set in high school. I think they graduate and go into college at some point, but it's like, okay, he's been doing that for a while now.
when he began, he actually was in high school.
Yes. And at some point they just kind of kept his casting call as high school age boy.
Yeah.
And just like he shows up on set and they're like, oh, you're really tall and handsome and
fucking muscular. Uh-oh. And
yeah,
there's that scene in 21 Jump Street where the coach says Channing Tatum, like, you have the muscular definition of like a 30-year-old. What did you go through puberty at 7?
Yeah. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it was weird. I don't know how we get off on this tangent. I guess that was just something that bugged me throughout the whole movie.
Sure. And I understand, like, it's playing fast and loose. And certainly that's something that, like, true to my character would probably bug me for the most part. But I shrug it off.
I was able to let go of it because, honestly, he's a very winning screen performance.
Yes.
And
yes.
I would have loved, like, a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern style movie about him and Krista. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like I can't even imagine the conversations that must have gone on between them because of the nonsense that Nadine was pulling.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like that to me is the most kind of crucial relationship in the film. And I really appreciated that because like, I can definitely understand, because they go through painstaking effort to make it very clear that Nadine basically has one friend, and one friend mm-hmm. that she's kind of grown up to kind of trust and kind of lean on, and that they've kind of had each other's backs. But to me, it kind of sucks because it never gives Krista the moment where she, like, has any other friends. Like, we never see her hang out with anybody else.
We see the party scene.
Yeah, I was about to say post-party, like, we get that, but not beforehand.
Yeah, and so it basically makes Krista seem like they have each other, and I don't know, and the way it kind of plays out, it plays out like that, but I just wish they would have given Krista one other friend.
I was going to ask if you thought that Nadine would allow Krista to have another friend.
And that's the question, because the way she reacts to Krista even having Happiness, even though it's her brother, you know, is so just like, no, you have to choose. And it's just like, what the fuck doing right now?
This was, like, one of my issues with the movie, was the fact that, like, Nadine keeps making these proclamations about people, and no one ever, like, really pushes back that hard. I kept wanting, because, like, my memories of teenagehood, that's probably a word, were a lot of, like, stupid circular conversations with friends that were all emotion and exposition without ever actually getting anywhere. Mm-hmm. And that probably kept going into way longer than it should have, like, into college, honestly. Because, like, at a certain point, all you want to say is how you feel, and it's just, like, it becomes an exorcism of the soul. But, like, that never really happens in this. Like, we don't get any, like, fucking... Like, Nadine calls out Krista in the middle of a burger shack, but Krista never really gets to, like, say anything back. Like, she's never saying, like, for God's sakes, like, I'm lonely, your brother's not that bad, like, we should all... Mm. Instead, she's just like, come to a party with us. And it's like, you know that in reality, there would have been, like, a horrifying-to-listen-to two-hour conversation where Krista talks about how lonely she is. We don't know anything about her home. Well, no, her home life is shit. We learned that. And so she could be like, you know, my dad walked out, and Darian's a really nice guy, and he does so much, and I think that you're not giving enough credit. And then Nadine could be like, you know, you always take the side of people other than me. And Krista will be like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. And then, like, that would give them a reason to split apart, other than Nadine just, like, basically shutting down and walking away, which is...
Well, I think it's a demonization of her character as well, in the sense that she would be so passive when someone says all these horrible things about her. Like, that's
Krista
why
would be
she
so
would
passive?
Still... Yeah, so, I'm sorry. Yeah, that Krista would still be friends with Nadine over this years because... she just wouldn't say anything about that. I mean, I think that's possible that that's what that characterization is trying to say. As you're saying this, I do see where you're coming from, where this is thinner in terms of motivations of why they would stay friends or why we didn't get that big moment. But I think, again, that, like, given what we see of Krista, like, the first thing they do is she accidentally kills the caterpillar in the pencil case. So it's not...
Yeah, and
I know that's a random thing to point out, but, like, I think that says something about the dynamic between them.
But it's a problem that I had throughout a lot of the film, because, honestly, like, she treats her brother like he's just a random popular jock that she doesn't really know that well. They fucking live together. Like, how is it that they've gone 4 years without her, without having a conversation about this? Like, I guess we didn't even mention that her dad
dies. I know some people who have not talked to their siblings, like, at all, despite living with them.
I guess, well, but it's is she really so blind that she doesn't realize that her mother's going through, like, a slow motion breakdown and her brother's holding things together? Like, is that...
Yes!
but there's not enough there to, like, really prop that up. Like, I don't feel a history between them. She has one anecdote about giving him a pillow, but, like, that's it. Otherwise, it seems like they never speak to each other.
Well, and I don't think they do. And there's a couple of things that I want to bring up. First off, it seems like Nadine is shunting responsibility as much as possible. She mentions at one point that she doesn't have a driver's license, so she can basically have people drive her around. And what that classically is she doesn't want to take on the responsibility of being able to drive. Not that their family necessarily could afford a third vehicle in the family, but like she it doesn't look like she has a job. She doesn't have any kind of responsibilities that I can tell. She doesn't clean her room ever, apparently, which is, you know, like, I mean, that's teenagers, period, right? So she's shunting responsibility at any given opportunity. She, instead of, like, I really wish she would have fessed to having a party when she says that she didn't do her homework, because it would have given Woody Harrelson's character a moment to be like, holy shit, you had a party?
You want to call two people getting, well, one of them getting blitzed together a party?
For two best friends that don't have any other people that they can kind of interact with socially, yes.
That's more that's of a definitely a party. Party.
Okay, whatever.
Also, anyways. I think it's interesting that Krista, like, had nothing to drink or, like, barely anything. And
I think,
fucking Nadine was blitzed.
I think Krista definitely had something to drink, but she realized quickly probably Nadine was going to spiral and just said, okay.
This is not a new experience for her.
Yeah.
It's a codependent relationship in that sense.
But, I mean, you were mentioning how Krista doesn't really have a conversation with her, and neither does, what's his name?
Darian?
Erwin.
Erwin? Oh, yeah. Poor Erwin. Poor
both,
second
hold on,
prize
hold on.
Erwin.
Hold on. Both of them at various points mention straight up, they basically tell Nadine, they're like, you talk too much. I can't get in a word to you, period, because the only thing that you do is you talk and you talk and you talk and you talk and you talk. And then you complain.
I just figured out the song that's going to end this episode.
And then you complain about the fact that, like, you aren't getting conversation back from people. And so I think it definitely paints that picture pretty prominently that Nadine, A, is shunting responsibility at any given chance, but also B, she continuously talks over people and doesn't allow them to really kind of have a conversation with her so much as get talked at to. And I think that's kind of the reason why everything kind of hits the wall at some point, because people are finally tired of her not taking the responsibility and not listening and not actually, you know, seeing what's going on around her. And I think that's a very, you know, teen portrait that is kind of real, because I mean, honestly, like, high school, so many people, and, you know, I know it's a cliche to say it, especially since I'm fucking 30 now, and it's like, you know, all of life is just kind of like there, and it's like, yeah, if I could redo, like, I'm not saying that I didn't live it up in high school, but holy shit, as much as I wanted to get out of high school, I look back and I'm like, yeah, I do high school again.
Oh,
yeah,
fuck no. Like, fuck no. Wait,
fuck no, indeed.
Wait, do you mean, like, would you do it now, or would you go back to, like, 2000 and do it again?
Both.
Fuck no. Fuck
yeah,
no.
I had a lot of fun in high school, so, you know.
I had fun in high school, but Jesus Christ, is it good to be out of there.
Eh,
fuck
I don't know.
That. No. Ugh. Jesus. High school. If I were given the choice, like, between death and high school, I'd fucking kill myself.
But I mean, do you understand what I'm talking about? Like, when people kind of push back against Nadine and basically tell her, hey, like, you don't ever listen. So I think that's kind of their workaround. of like Krista not having that conversation with her, because like if Krista started to bring it up, Nadine would, just like you mentioned, just shut down and just be like,
or deflect.
Or deflect, yeah.
I guess so, but I don't feel like they did enough to really drive that home. Like, I know that they have people outright telling her that she talks too much, but like, this movie never feels like these are real built-up three-dimensional characters. Like, they feel like they're stock, and they break away from that a little bit in like the last 20 minutes, but it's never really enough. Like, I don't understand why Erwin pursues her so much.
I mean, I think it's a part of his social isolation. I mean, when you think of the background,
not really
that we're
socially isolated, he's got like a huge group of friends.
But like, that's like them being friends because they're misfits. But not like, I don't get a sense that he's really good friends with them. I get a sense he's friends with them because of like their mutual interests and the fact that they're on the fringe of the social circles.
I don't think so, because just based on her talking to those people in the hall and then all the people around him at the end of the movie, like, the guy seems legitimately popular and seems to legitimately enjoy those people. Like, when she shows up, he's not like, oh, let's get away from these random people who I don't really care about. He's like, let me introduce you to this group of people who are important to me, and let me pull you back so that you can become part of them.
I think that's a criticism that you can definitely lobby against it, or lob at the film, specifically in Erwin's case. But at the same time, the way the character is written potentially is inconsistent, because the easiest way for him to get Nadine to come over would have been to say, I have a baller house, I have a pool, my parents are gone for 3 months, I'm throwing a party this weekend with a bunch of my nerdy friends, let's hang out. But that conversation never happens at any point in the film, and in fact Nadine is like, you've had this house
for
3 months and you haven't like done any, like, you haven't thrown a fucking party, like, you know, like the minute that Nadine's mother is out of town, she calls up her brother and is like, dibs.
And he's just for like, me and my one friend.
I love his reaction. He's just like, what the fuck are you talking
about? It's like,
about
what right the fuck
now?
Are you talking about?
We don't do dibs, and you can sit in your room with your one friend and no one will even know you're there.
Yeah.
Nothing in this movie was particularly like insightful or cutting. There was never a moment where I felt like the movie did anything particularly daring or even meaningful. I mean, like, the second that they pull up outside of school when she's like in elementary school and she's like, this is my dad who's always great at like helping out me and my mom. And I'm like, he's going to be dead in 5 minutes. And he fucking was. And
I don't know. Like, I understand a little bit of the criticism of having kind of a paint by numbers narrative like plot points. Like, I understand
it's
that
how they do it.
Exactly.
I don't feel like they, like, that's my issue, is I don't feel they do it any better or even particularly good to begin with.
And see, I completely disagree. I think the journey here is so much fun, and it's the fact that like I was even rooting for Nadine despite everything that she does, I think it says something to me that like I wasn't cringing at every moment we spend with her, because we spend the entire fucking movie with her. And if she was as disastrously like I don't know, like this character could have easily been just so loathsome to spend time with. Yeah. And
I think I would have liked it if
not.
She was more loathsome, honestly.
See? And
I feel like what was that?
You want the Bomback version of this?
Yeah, let's make her a real Greenberg. No, just fucking anything. Like, she's such a non-entity to me that, again, I really found myself wishing that I could spend more time with the other characters. Mm-hmm. It just it really didn't make any sense to me why we were spending so much time with this person, especially when, again, like, it was just like, it was so infuriating how obvious everything that was happening was and how little the movie went to even, like, I don't like Juno, but god damn it, at least that fucking movie was, like, trying something with its dumbass dialogue. But this movie wasn't even doing that. This movie was not even as well or
oh
as
my
catchy.
God, shut up, Brian.
it's just not good. It's not bad, but it's so basic.
No,
there's
okay.
nothing
not.
To it.
All right.
Because these characters never have any real conversations, because it's constantly just Nadine running off at the mouth until she finally shuts up. I mean, there's no, you don't feel any real connection. You don't feel any real relationships. And it's just fine. Like, that we're stuck with this girl for an hour and 44 minutes. Bill, I'm doing your job. but it's just, it's not good. It's not insightful. It's not particularly cutting. And it's not particularly interesting. To me. Obviously, you people disagree.
I love the "to me" at the end.
it's really not. Like, there's, to me, this movie is so, it's so paint by numbers. It's so on the rails. It's so lacking in any sense of danger or experimentation or even insight or specificity that it really just, it's like, it's not a slog, but it's just like, it's like when you go on one of those rides at Disney World that's meant for like a 5-year-old. Like, I'm moving forward. There are trees. There are going to be different trees ahead. But, like, there's nothing here that's really reaching out to me or speaking to me anyway or making me feel anything beyond just momentum forward.
Well, and I think part of that issue is going to be whether you connect to the main character, Nadine, or not. And clearly you've made it very obvious that you find her kind of insufferable as a character and the way that she's kind of written and portrayed.
I find her safely insufferable, which is less compelling than if she were just really insufferable.
Sure.
Like, as a man who grew up and was around 17-year-old girls, like, they
what?
Can be...
that's a weird sentence.
I was
yes,
17
that's the
too.
Thing.
I grew up and I was in the presence of 17-year-old girls as they were growing up. And I remember the raw terror of listening.
I was 17 once. That's all that needs to be said.
No, because I'm not a girl, so it
You're
doesn't matter.
You're doubling down on this.
But when I was, let me see if I can phrase this to appease you two. When I was at a socially acceptable age to be hanging around 17-year-old girls, when okay. I too was in that age range, the conversations and the interactions that they would have with certain people were terrifying. I remember being in a basement with a group of friends as one girl that we knew was upstairs having a quote-unquote conversation with her mother that turned into screaming and, like, cup-throwing and threats of violence, and, like, that was normal for them.
Sure.
Like, that's some compelling shit, man. And I was just listening to it like a radio play through a ceiling.
This, you like Cassavetes.
Yeah, this was just, like... It was like a bad ABC sitcom.
What the fuck are you talking about?
There's nothing here. It's a lack of specificity and it's a lack of danger. I've said it. Like, there's no...
I want to know what Disney Channel, Hallmark movie, and ABC sitcom this is like.
Modern Family.
Because I would love to watch it. This is like Modern Family.
The Secret Life of a Teenage Girl or an American Teenager.
Secret Life of a Teenage Girl.
Wait, what?
I've actually seen that. Have you seen that?
I think I saw one episode once, yeah. But now I can't remember if it was that or if it was like one of
I'm
those
push
other
the
TV
fuck
shows.
Back on that, man. Like, that's
it's just I walked out of this legitimately shocked that it was rated R. And
what?
Maybe that says more about the MPAA, but like, there's nothing in this movie that should make it rated R.
I don't necessarily disagree with that sentiment, but I also don't think The Matrix should be rated R either, and so the MPAA is just a sham. But, you know,
well,
like...
The Matrix has a shit ton of violence in it. I mean, I'm fine with that.
Not that blood, like, very little of it has any blood or any actual consequence, because they set up the parameters of the film as, hey, all these people you see dying, yeah, they're not real anyways.
So that was obviously an argument that worked a lot better for Sucker Punch.
Yeah.
Many years later. I don't think it's out of line to say that this is a safe, uninteresting to me movie that doesn't really it doesn't deserve a rated R. And again, that says more about the MPAA than anything else.
Let's say this film is PG-13, so all of a sudden I've knocked down one of your critiques against it. Is it a little bit easier to stomach that this film is safe and easy to digest because it's PG-13?
That still doesn't make it interesting. All my complaints will still be there. It's just that it will feel like the MPAA agreed with me. What I'm saying, Bill, is that for everything that you two are saying about its honesty and everything, to be rated R like that, it's just like, I don't get it. And I don't feel like there's any honesty. I don't feel like this even is one of those movies where it's like, it feels like it was rated R just because of the emotional violence or the rawness of the thoughts and ideas going on. Like, no, there's nothing here. It's fine, though. Like, this is a fine movie. I'm sure that people will watch it and enjoy it, and that's great. But, like, to hear that it's going to be in someone's top 10 of the year is baffling. Michael, I'm sorry.
I'm sure Triple Nine is going to be in your top 10, and I will fucking have a tantrum.
Actually, yeah. It might not be. We've gotten a lot of really good movies lately. There's nothing new. Like, there's nothing. Even its handle on technology isn't particularly interesting.
Okay.
Other than the placement of the send button, but it's not like she's on social media like charting the trajectory of her friend and her brother's relationship from the outside, growing more and more hateful as more and more people seem to get on board. It's not she's seeing pictures of people at parties.
Do.
What?
That's not what people do.
What?
That's not what some people do.
That's not what
Let's
some
say
people
that.
Do. I think
I think that's my main critique against your critique of this film is Nadine is not the character that you think that or that you want out of this
because she's
high school
hardly a character
kind of film.
I honestly couldn't
sure.
tell you how and, she and, should act in any given situation other
and,
than
and
the most
part
obvious
of that,
way
part of that is that she's kind of this loner insufferable person to be around, and so you're like, okay, but she needs to be more insufferable. Well, no, if she was more insufferable, then either the film would be, like Michael said, it would be Greenberg, or the film would be she would have more friends because she would be so loud and outspoken that she would just attract sure. certain kind of people that are also kind of self-destructive.
But
she's
have,
not
like her teacher there, bugging her about what a shitty person
there's that
she
great
is.
Scene where she's
like his criticisms of her never seem to line up with the reality of her.
What?
Bill, you just said if she were more insufferable, she would have friends. But like the way that her teacher treats her is the way you would treat that insufferable asshole.
Yeah. What about it?
I'm saying, what are you talking about? I just told you. Bill is saying if she were more insufferable, and I'm saying her teacher's already treating her as though she is the hypothetical more insufferable person that Bill just talked about.
Her... yes.
But she's not that.
Understand.
So why is he treating her like that? He is talking to the more interesting character that I wish she was. And that's
because
a problem, because the movie doesn't even know how to look at her.
Okay. Well, I mean, I just think your issue is that she isn't enough. And I think I think that's kind of the point of this film, is that it's not trying to be uber specific in painting her as a character. It's supposed to be kind of the way she dresses is this really kind of weird way, but she's got that one thing that makes her kind of stand out in this crowd, and that's her like love of like pretty fashionable shoes for her age, right? And like even the boy that she like really wants to hook up with,
yeah,
he notices her shoes, but that's the only fucking thing that he can
she's
mention
like fake
to her.
Special,
yeah. She, that's the only thing that he can be like, he looks her up and down and is like, I like your shoes. And it's just like, that's the most like,
so what God, do we think it means like, that like, the, what a Nick way, character what a, likes her shoes, but that Erwin likes her sweater. What are we reading into that?
I think Erwin is just like, that's a very colorful. Yeah. That's a very colorful sweater. I wonder where you get it from. And like, it goes nowhere. So like, I love that. I love that they get this guy that's like trying to have a conversation with her and is like setting her up. Like, hey, what'd you do this weekend? And she's just like, she says what she did this weekend and doesn't ask back. Right. And it's kind of like, okay, this is talking to a brick wall, and he's trying, and yet I love that the moment that she kind of puts it in his brain, or he puts it in her brain that he's kind of someone that she could potentially reach out to, she does, and it's just like, yes, mm-hmm. thank you, like it rewards that character interaction in a way that a lot of films I don't think either would or aren't keen enough to kind of pick up on these kind of girl boy interactions that are innocent and yet that are also like reaching out to other people and basically saying like, hey, like I have a similar interest in you or as you, potentially we could hang out and it wouldn't be terrible. Right. And I feel like this it sucks that this is a film that she is 17 in. Like, I feel like this is a film that maybe would be a little bit more appropriate if she was a little bit younger. But then the sexual politics of it would be kind of awkward, like really awkward. Like
kid if she territory.
Was like, yeah, if she was like 15. Like, it would just be like, you know.
Bill, I think that what you just said about how this movie would make more sense if she was younger, but it would be a little, like, harder to deal with in that way, is, like, an illustration of my problem with this movie.
Sure. And you want kind of that you want something that this film is not delivering and isn't necessarily trying to, right? Like that was
like
both your criticism and
feints it trying it.
And see, I think it knows exactly what it wants to be, and it's doing that a pretty damn good job at being that. Like, this is not a hard R coming of age film. This is a quirky, not quite Juno, but interesting and earnest look at being 17 and, you know, the sexual politics of today's reality and how teens can interact with each other in ways that, like, the parents don't have any control over, and that teenagers can be very, like, you know, she doesn't really, we don't establish how much she knows how to drive or not, but definitely when she drives away in her mom's car, like what the, like, as a parent, like, what the fuck would you do? Like, A, you don't have a car, so you can't go like drive them down, and B, like, oh my God, like that would just drive you insane. And look, like, haven't we all gotten multiple messages from our parents in certain moments? And I think that's kind of the reality of this film, is that it's probably too safe for you, Brian, because it's painting a picture of reality that for some people is earnest, and for some people they're like, yeah, but like, where's the drama? Because this kid isn't fucked up enough, or this kid isn't crazy enough. And it's like, that's why I sure. connect to her because I mm-hmm. wasn't that bonkers crazy. Like, you know, I was just a little fucked up, and so are a lot of teenagers because they're dealing with some shit. And it's like, that's kind of what this film is. And, you know, one thing that I think is really interesting that we haven't mentioned at all to this point is at one point she kind of speaks to God and is asking for a handout on the bathroom stall.
Like two or three times, yeah.
And like, she's like, I know you've never listened to me, or I know I never talked to you, and like, that you don't have any reason to. And like, I think
she says every time I ask you for something, you just fuck me over more.
Sure. And part of that is surrounding the fact that like her best friend, yeah, like her definite best friend was her father, right? That was the person that like she truly connected to. Mm-hmm. And like, she lost him at a very critical age, I think. You know, it was like, what,
13?
Well, but it was like 4 years ago or something like that, 5 years ago, something like that. And
if
so,
she was 13,
like,
and she's now on the edge of 17, it would be 4 years.
Yeah. And so, like, she lost her father at a very crucial point. And I don't think they play that up enough. I think in this case, it would have been smart if they would have played that up a little bit more, because it would have given her a reason why she just can't interact with anyone her own age, because she connected to her father and maybe she was able to talk to her father, and her father never really set her up to be able to talk to other people her own age or just the people around her. And he was gone before she was at an age where, like, that's necessary, right? Because you got no worries when you're, like, 12.
I think the other thing that's important about that, too, is that...
Middle school was tough for me. Middle school was worse than high school.
See, like, meh.
The other thing that was important to me in terms of the father thing is that, like, that's... also the crucial moment when you stop seeing your parents as only your parents and you start seeing them as another person as well. So I think that is why that relationship is also important, in the sense that she's seeing her mom as someone who is going on these dates and, as you're saying, going into these nervous breakdowns. And like, so that sense of that is totally fractured, that both those things happen at the same time. So not only is she losing that parent, but she's now realizing, like, the mask is gone and I can't really be, I'm still being coddled, but I'm not really recognizing that my mom needs this help as well, and that my brother is going through this as well. And so it's that moment when you're a teenager and when the whole world revolves around you, and you think you're special and unique and everything, and how you, as you said, Bill, you have problems and you're fucked up, but you're not that fucked up. And it's just how all of those things connect. And yes, that's not like directly mentioned in the text, but I think just the way, especially as we're talking about the fact that she doesn't have responsibilities and the fact that her relationship with her mom is always linked to her needs, and the way that she talks to her son before Nadine, or, you know, whenever something bad has happened. Like, you know, I definitely have friends who have, you know, single moms, and I'm not saying this is, you know, always, but the mom will go to the older brother as, you know, the father surrogate. And like, I just think that all of these things combine in ways that are both, as you're saying, like, fine specificity in some of the conversations and things like that, but also the character is general enough that it can encompass all these general factors without being like you being able to predict exactly where she's going to be.
Mm-hmm. But I did say that I was able to predict everything.
Well, but like, yeah, that's not a criticism that Michael is lobbing at the film.
Right, but he said there was, never mind, it doesn't matter.
No, what I'm saying in terms of character, I'm not talking about plot. I'm talking about in terms of character, that it is slippery enough when it comes to her general characteristics, but then when it comes...
Oh, we just lost that Michael. Oh, no, he's back.
Hello?
Yeah, we lost the last bit of what you just said.
Okay, so plot-wise, as...
Yes.
Someone used the term paint by numbers, which, yes, it is very paint by numbers, but... And the character aspects are slippery enough that it can be more universal, but then when it comes to conversations and things like this, which Brian, you're gonna disagree with us here, but those conversations felt real enough, and those dynamics, when it came to those moments, I liked the way that it lived in those. You know, like, there's a bunch of teen movies I can think of where just like an argument with where a sibling is applying. And that's not the case here. Like, when an argument happens, it goes on for days and days. Like, Nadine and her brother's name? Darian. Nadine and Darian hold a grudge towards each other for, like, weeks. Like, it doesn't go away. And so, like, that's just... I like the way that the... film, for like a few exceptions, doesn't really just wipe away things that happen. They have not necessarily consequences, but they're in the mind of the characters, and it affects them, whether it's simply Nadine deciding that she's actually going to call Erwin because she feels totally alone on a weekend, or yeah, I forgot what I was going to say there. Yes, that. So yeah, I think that. Yeah, I like so much that this is able to go through the archetypes that have existed in so much teen movies, but it doesn't give her the happily ever after. Even the end of this movie is not like things are going to get better. It's just like, hey, this one thing is solved right now. Like, maybe...
Her problems with her mom are solved. Her problem with her brother and her best friend are solved. Her problem with Erwin is solved.
No.
I don't think they're resolved
that way.
Oh, my God. All right. Good for you all.
Yep.
Everyone in this movie gives her a pass. Everyone in this movie adapts to her... And at the end, it's happy and it's fine and everything is fixed to the point where it's gone back to where it had been, except now they're communicating a little bit better. If that's not a wholly happy ending, I don't know what is.
I think there's definitely a uptick at the end of the film, but I don't think everything is necessarily peachy. I think Nadine is finally starting to accept, because people have beaten her over the head with it at this point, that, hey, we're also humans and we also have to interact with you. And at some point we have to get along. Otherwise, this is going to be complete and utter shit. And so I think Nadine is finally starting to accept that. And that's her accepting her reality, not necessarily because they have been catering to her to this point. But the more this film spirals, the more it becomes clear that they're no longer catering to her, and she's resisting that. And finally, she's like she comes to the brother and is like, hey, I'm sorry. And what does she say? Like, she can't even get enough words out without like not being able to talk at that moment, because like she doesn't have a history of apologizing to people or accepting people and being like, I'm sorry. Like, I in this character's kind of reality, it seems like she's never said I'm sorry before. Like,
but then she's mad when other people don't do the same thing to her.
Exactly.
Again,
so,
none of this is... That's fine, but like, it's not interesting. It's not new. It's not... I can't even keep talking about this.
That's all right. Then don't quit. Stop talking.
Yeah. Like, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So I found her reactions and her interactions with kind of the people around her kind of delightful. So, yeah, I think it is a safe film enough to where it can be watched by a lot of people. And yeah, I think it kind of sucks that this isn't PG-13, because I think this would really find an audience with a lot of teenagers, and specifically adults that have teenagers or kids about to approach that age, or kids just out of that age, that, you know, the adults are like, I don't understand how to fucking interact with these crazy human beings. And yeah, I think it's interesting in that, again, some of these themes that it plays with are pretty on the nose. And my biggest thing is, I think for a lot of parents, the common criticism for them about sex and things like that is that they're not mature enough. And I think this film paints a very clear picture of Nadine being a 17-year-old and not being able to kind of handle the situations that she's potentially going to put herself into. And like, this is nightmare fuel for a lot of parents, where they're just like, no, 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 no. And this film like plays that up. Like, we don't see her grab a condom. We don't see her do certain things that you would hope that she would do. She very much could have gotten sexually assaulted by this boy in his car. And yet the film is not Juno, right? It's not like, oh, mm-hmm. let's pay that consequence off. Instead, it's like, no, let's give her kind of an internal struggle of what the situation means, and show to her that some dudes, in given a opportunity, would definitely jump at it. So yeah, I like that aspect of the film specifically. So.
Oh, you know what? I just realized that they do bring up virginity in this movie.
At what point?
When she's like, oh, you should walk up to him in Petland and just say, hey, do you know where the beta fish are? And also put your penis in me. Nadine says, oh my God, wouldn't that be weird, losing your virginity in a Petland? And then she's like, actually, I think like with all the tropical fish, it would be very spiritual. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I just wanted to bring that up because I know you'd ask that question. That doesn't reflect any feelings towards the film or anything.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Michael, any final thoughts?
No, I'm good.
Okay, so that's The Edge of 17. It's out in theaters now, surprisingly wide, surprisingly acclaimed.
Dick.
Let's get out of here. If you are interested in The Love Witch, don't forget that you can watch Viva, the previous film by that director, Anna Biller, currently on Mubi, the streaming cinema service. Every day, you get a new wonderful film to watch. You have 30 days to check it out. Mubi.com/filmstage will get you 30 days free of Mubi. That is MUBI.com/FIL. Why am I spelling out film stage? This fucking episode's been going on too long. MUBI.com/filmstage. Check it out and get your free 30 days. That's about that. Once again, follow us on Twitter @FilmStageShow. Follow us on Facebook. Search for The Film Stage Show. And go on iTunes. And it's Christmas time. Give us a present. Give us a comment and a rating on iTunes. All right, let's tell the fine people where we can be found between now and the next time. Bill Graham.
You can find me on Twitter @CableBFG. You can also find me writing about movies on The Film Stage and FreshFiction.tv. And keep your ears perked up, or I guess, yeah, ears perked up for When a Monster Calls is finally released.
Are you in that?
No, but it's delightful.
So that's just a general plug for When a Monster Calls.
Yes, okay. A film that I adore.
Keep your eyes peeled, I think, since it is a visual medium that will... Anyway, Michael Seidel, where can you find you online?
You can find me online at at Snydell, and I'll be talking about how there should be more movies about teens. And this week, it should probably be up at this point. I wrote about Eyes My Mother for Paste.
Okay.
So you can check that out. I had some feelings about it.
All right. You can find me live tweeting my rewatch of Kids to actually watch an edgy teenage film on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. You can find my personal site at dearfilm.net. And that's about it. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us, and tune in next week. I don't know precisely what we'll be talking about, but we will be having a roundtable coming out on Thursday/Friday, so check that out. Thank you again. Have a great week.